in the New Science of Politics, where I spoke of the apocalypse of man, meaning on that occasion the discovery of human possibilities which characterizes the modern period. No doubt that this discovery was made, but stressing the discovery alone would again not take into account the reductionist context of the discovery. The discovery of man had to be paid for by the death of God, as this phenomenon was called by Hegel and Nietzsche. The term ecophrenic revolt, distinguishing this experience of the exuberant ego from the experience of the theophanic constitution of humanity, is the best I can do terminologically at present. The term metastatic apocalypse may require a little explanation. I had to develop the term on occasion of the Israelite prophets. In the prophecy of Isaiah, we run into the oddity that Isaiah counseled the king of Judah not to rely on the fortifications of Jerusalem and the strength of his army, but on his faith in Yahweh. If he would have the true faith, the God would do the rest by producing an epidemic or a panic among the enemies, and the danger to the city would dissolve. The king had common sense enough not to follow the advice of the prophet, but rather to rely on fortifications and military equipment. But the problem was put that through an act of faith, the prophet assumed the structure of reality could be effectively changed. In studying this problem and trying to understand it, my first idea, of course, was that the prophet indulged in magic, or believed in magic. That would not have been surprising, because in the history of Israel, it had been the function of prophets, for instance, to guide the hand of the king in shooting a bow against the enemy as a magic operation that would result in victory. What happened in the case of Isaiah would have been what in modern psychology, by Nietzsche or Freud, would be called a sublimation of the more primitive physical magic. Still, I felt uneasy about it, and I consulted about the matter, especially with Gerhard von Rath in Heidelberg, who was horrified at the idea that a grandiose spiritual prophet like Isaiah should be a magician. I was so impressed by his attitude that I made a concession. I did not use the term magic for the practice advised by Isaiah, but coined a new term characterizing the peculiar sublimated magic belief in a transfiguration of reality through an act of faith. And this kind of faith I called metastatic faith, or faith in a metastasis of reality through an act of faith. I'm not so sure that today I would make this concession, because the problem of magic is obscured by this language. It is, of course, an act of magic, so one that has to be distinguished in various details to be summarized under the head of sublimation, quotation marks, from more primitive magical operations. If one would really draw a hard line of difference between magic and metastatic faith, I'm afraid the very important connection between the two phenomena of producing a desired result by means outside of the cause-effect relations in nature would be smudged. An important development in my understanding of the problems that worried me throughout the 40s and well into the writing of Order and History was marked by my correspondence with Alfred Schütz, on the problems of consciousness. They were not published at the time, but only in 1966 as the first part of my volume on anamnesis. The correspondence with Schütz was precipitated by the reading of Husserl's Krisis der europäischen Wissenschaften. Husserl's study interested me greatly because of its magnificent sweep from Descartes to his own work. It also irritated me considerably because of the somewhat naive arrogance of a philosopher who believed that his method of phenomenology had at last opened what he called the apodictic horizon of philosophy, and that from now on everybody who wanted to be a solid philosopher had to be a follower of Husserl. This arrogance reminded me a bit too strongly of various other final philosophies, like those of Hegel or Marx, and also the conviction of National Socialists that theirs was ultimate truth. Especially I was disgusted by Husserl's language, whereby the philosopher considered himself as the functionary of the spirit, because such language reminded me of recent experiences with functionaries of another sort. In continuation of my earlier analysis of consciousness, in Die Form des amerikanischen Geistes, I now went into an elaborate criticism of Husserl's conception of consciousness, the decisive point being that his model of consciousness was the sense perception of objects in the external world. While one could agree to the sophistications of analysis which he brought to bear on this model of perception, it seemed to me ridiculous to pretend that there was nothing to consciousness but the consciousness of objects of the external world. By that time, in 1942, I knew already enough about classic, patristic, and scholastic philosophy in order to know that the philosophers who had founded philosophy on an analysis of consciousness were analyzing a few phenomena of consciousness besides the consciousness of objects in the external world. I went therefore into the question what really were the experiences which form a man's consciousness, and I did that by an anamnesis, a recollection of decisive experiences of my childhood. As a matter of fact, I wrote 20 brief sketches, each giving such an early experience, so that they added up to something like an intellectual autobiography up to the age of 10. The phenomena described were definitely phenomena of consciousness, because they described my consciousness of various areas of reality as a child. And these experiences had very little to do with fixing objects of sense perception. For instance, one of the experiences which had stuck firmly enough to be recollected about 40 years later was the monk of Heisterbach. Heisterbach was the ruin of some medieval monastery in the neighborhood of Königswinter, where we frequently went for a Sunday excursion. The monk of Heisterbach was the monk who got lost and did return only after 1,000 years and discovered that 1,000 years had passed for him like a day. Such problems of time, concentration and shortening obviously are not problems of sense perception and constitute very relevant parts, at least of my consciousness, even if they don't of Husserl's. In this manner I went through such experiences as the anxieties and fascinations aroused by standing on the border of the known world in one of Andersen's fairy tales, and looking north into a mysterious horizon of infinity. Or experiences of festival moments in the life of man, in watching passing steamers on the Rhine with their night parties, and so forth. These types of experience constitute consciousness, and this is the real consciousness a man has, unless somebody wants to insist that my childhood was entirely different from that of any other child in the history of mankind. And these experiences, through participation in various areas of reality, they constitute the horizon of existence in the world. The stress lies on experiences of reality, without being selective about them, but being open to all of them and keeping them in balance. That is what I understood as the philosopher's attitude, and that is the attitude which I also found reflected in the open existence of all great philosophers who by that time had come to my attention. To replace this openness of reality, which at that time already had been fortified in my knowledge by Bergson's conception of the open soul, that seemed to me to be the center of philosophy. And these experiences now required a definite vocabulary for its expression, which fortunately I did not have to develop, but gradually to learn from others who had gone through the same experiences and already found the vocabulary to signify the analytical steps in the exploration of their experiences. At the center of the problem I found the experience of participation, meaning thereby the reality of being in contact with reality outside myself. This participation, again at that time, was already being fortified by my knowledge of the myth as analyzed by the members of the Chicago Oriental Institute, with the category of consubstantiality developed by the Frankfurts and probably taken over from Levi-Bruhl. Man is consubstantial with the reality which he experiences, or he couldn't experience it. Among philosophers of the 20th century, I found considerable confirmation through the radical empiricism of William James. James's study on the question, what is consciousness, struck me at the time, and still strikes me, as one of the most important philosophical documents of the 20th century. In developing his concept of the pure experience, William James had put his finger on the reality